Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and Professor Kerry Brown makes a welcome first visit to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of his book, The New Emperor's Power and Princelings in China. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Dr. Brown is Director of the China Studies Centre at the University of Sydney and Associate Fellow of Chatham House in London. With 20 years' experience of life in China, and he has worked in education, business and government, including a term as First Secretary at the British Embassy in Beijing. Professor Brown is the author of Contemporary China, which came out in 2013, and also Friends and Enemies, the Past, Present and Future of the Communist Party of China, which he wrote with Will Hutton, came out in 2009, and Struggling China in the 21st Century. And so tonight, Professor Brown's going to talk to us on a topic related to his book, The New Emperors. Professor Brown, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for inviting me here, and it's good to be here for the first time. About 10 years ago, when I was an official at the British Embassy in Beijing, I remember a gentleman came to see me one summer afternoon, who was at that time based in the city of Dalian. And he came to make an inquiry about, I think he had just married a Chinese lady and he wanted to know what was the process for him to get a visa for his wife to the UK. I came across the guy, I think, about a year later when I actually visited Dalian on the northeast coast of China. And I remember we met in the Dalian Bingguan, the Dalian Hotel, one of the old Soviet-style hotels then in the city, very lovely city. At that time, the party secretary of that city, the most powerful politician, was a man called Bo Xilai. The guy that I met, I don't remember anything about our conversation. All I do remember about the Dalian Hotel was that it had the most spectacular and incredibly vivid, almost pornographic pictures on the walls. And that has kind of distracted me from what he said because I can't remember anything of it today. About 10 years later, on a winter evening in November 2011, that man was murdered. Neil Hayward was a British businessman who went from Dalian, where he'd been a teacher, running, I think, a small English language school, to greater and better things, I suppose, after I initially knew him. And I did meet him very briefly in 2009 in London. At that time, he was very close, the first real foreigner of his generation close to a member of the Politburo of China, that group of 24 incredibly powerful people. The man he was close to was Bo Xilai. Bo Xilai's wife was accused, and then she was kind of committed for his murder about 2 years later. But it also led to the fall of Bo Xilai, and he is now in prison. He had the chance, actually, in 2012 to become a member of the Summit of Power in China, the Standing Committee of the Politburo. But when I think about Neil and his experiences, Neil Hayward, and the fact that he ended up murdered in a pretty grimy three-star hotel on the outskirts of Chongqing, there is only one conclusion. Someone like me, who is way outside the kind of circles of the lives and the sort of world that he moved in, the only thing that I can conclude is that power in China is something different, and we should never, ever take it easily. Power in China does strange things to people. It does strange things to people that experience it. It does strange things to people that are close to it. Those that enter the Standing Committee of the Politburo go through a kind of door where they disappear from our world. They go to a world where they will never really see normal human beings in their social lives. They will probably never eat in a restaurant again in public. They will almost certainly go along roads which have been emptied of traffic because their worlds are kind of prepared before them. They will go around the world with extraordinarily well-prepared operations with security officers. They will live in a slightly sterile kind of distant world. Every now and again, they will try and break out of it. A remarkable story 2 years ago, just at the time when the current leader of China, Xi Jinping, became the most powerful person, the party secretary, there was an extraordinary article in a Hong Kong newspaper that appeared very briefly before it was taken down of a taxi driver one afternoon picking up these two gentlemen that were standing around the middle of the city and taking them to the central compound. He made some complaint, like taxi drivers always do. He was full of some wisdom about how the city was getting more polluted, the politicians were getting more corrupt, the world was getting worse and worse. But then he was stopped in his tracks by the fact that the man in the back said, a rather strange thing to say to any taxi driver anywhere, "Well, if you want GDP growth of 0.1% a year extra, you are going to have this kind of pollution." The taxi driver, with an amazing power of understatement, said, "This was no ordinary customer." In fact, he made it pretty clear afterwards that it was at that moment that he thought this man looked remarkably like President Xi. To this day, we do not know if that man was President Xi Jinping. But these stories of people trying to break out, almost like Peter the Great in Russia, who apparently used to go in the streets disguised as a sort of commoner in order to hear what the people said, are sort of tantalizing. And it might be, that they are just about possible. The reason why these people and their power are so incredible and important, and the reason why they affect people like you and me sitting here, long, long away from them, is because they are running the world's second largest economy, and that economy will almost certainly become the world's largest sometime in the next 10 to 15 years, if not quicker. The reason why they matter is because their environment seeps into our environment, their air quality issues, their food security challenges for 1.4 billion people are our issues. They will become bigger investors in our country, they will become bigger players in our world. There's nothing really that will stop this. There's nothing really why we should be particularly frightened in some ways as long as we work together. But the issue really is that their power is also power over us. So I think it's worthwhile for us to work out how this power operates. Why is it that this power is important? What is power in China? What does it smell like? What does it feel like? What does it look like? Well, I would suggest if you wanted to get some of those answers, you would take out the picture of those seven men that walked out on November the 15th at 11:42 in the morning in 2012 in the Great Hall of the People. Those seven men, Han Chinese, all over 50, all of them who'd served their lives in the Communist Party of China and the new leadership of what we call the fifth generation of leaders in China, the people who now run the country. If you want to see the face of power, look into their eyes, look at them, think about them, try and get to know them. And for the next few minutes, that's what I'm trying to help you, and also me, to do. They matter because they sit at the heart of an organisation, and that organisation, the Communist Party of China, is one of the most remarkable and extraordinary and the difficult to understand in the contemporary world. Founded in 1921 with only 13 members, it was incredible that it managed to be victorious in 1949. Decimated in the 1920s, destroyed by most of its opponents, regarded with disdain and disgust through most of its early years, it was a parasite of illegality, a kind of home for renegades, a kind of gangster-run entity that really, really was not likely to have the final power in this country. Most of its main members were wiped out in 1927. It had to fight a terrible and bloody war in the 1930s and 1940s. In 1949, it only won by the skin of its teeth. And yet we look at this party today, now in its ninth decade, and we see one of the most remarkable organizations the world has ever known. 85 million people, or 85 million people almost like a state within a state, with its own rules, with its own culture, with its own hierarchy, and at the top of it sits these seven men. But here is the greatest paradox of all, probably the greatest paradox of the modern world. The Communist Party, the moral mandate of which was to rise to power, to liberate the proletariat, to liberate China from colonialism, from all of the evils of the external world that had victimized and bullied it during the century of humiliation, the great winner of the Marxist-Leninist revolution in China, is now the world's greatest money-making machine. The Communist Party of China is like Midas, whatever it touches turns to gold. It is extraordinary. If it were tomorrow saying that there would be a national health service, it would be a trillion-dollar company. We love the party because we love money. And we love the way that the party makes money. That seems to be the message. And there's no easy way to see this. It's not like a political party, like parties in Australia or Europe or in North America. It really isn't like the political parties we have here, because it's almost like a kind of organisation which is everything to itself. Its own law court, its own ruler, its own lawmaker, its own kind of judge and jury. It's everything. It's a self-contained world. And so if we want to understand these people, there is one rule at the beginning that we must make clear. They are there because they are its faithful servants. It is not personal. It is not about them. They have given everything to be where they are, to be the servants of the party. And I suppose the second thing that we really need to understand, once we've got that clear, is that they are there because they have come from elsewhere. They have backgrounds. They are not anonymous. We look at them and we know that they are masters of concealment. Concealment is important in politics anywhere. In his great biography of Lyndon B. Johnson, Anthony Caro talks about the importance of concealment as someone rises to power. In his case, of course, he's writing about Lyndon B. Johnson. And he writes a very powerful line about how the amazing thing about power is it reveals. When someone comes to be powerful, when they come into positions of power, we start to see into their soul. But with the Chinese leadership over the last 10 years, with people like Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, the previous party secretary and premier, the two key people in China, we never really saw into their souls. Hu Jintao remained an enigma from the day he was in power to the day he left power. A man who famously had only one joke on Wikipedia, a man who was absolutely silent during most of China's great challenges, Hu Jintao remained hidden behind his mask. But with Xi Jinping, we have a different kind of politician. We have someone who looks a little like our politician, someone who wants to reach into the emotions of the Chinese people. We have someone who wants to tell us a story. What is the story that this man wants to tell us? This is the kind of story we have to understand to see the face of power in modern China. Well, we have to understand, I suppose, that he did come from a family that had profound links with the Communist Party. His father, Xi Zhongxun, was in fact a communist leader, a military leader. And his father was felled in 1962, way before the Cultural Revolution of 1967. From 1962 to the late 1970s, Xi Jinping, his son, never saw his father. Xi Jinping, therefore, can be described as a peasant emperor. That's the way that he's talked about in some commentary. He can be described as someone who has really come from a very, very humble background. But he's also royalty. He's also aristocracy. He is the faithful servant in a Confucian system, in many ways, of his father's memory. And that is why someone in Beijing described him as someone who would never let down the memory of his father. Xi Jinping, in fact, was a provincial leader for many years in Fujian province, in the southeast of China, a province exactly opposite Taiwan. And in those 16 years, there were two things that we can really notice about him and about the story, the narrative, the way that he tells his political soul in the world. The one thing that he said in 1991 was, "You should not think when you become a political leader that you do it for money." This is a counterintuitive thing to say in a China in which money is everywhere, in the air, in the soil, in the earth, it's all around you. And therefore, having a leader say something which is so absolutely against the actual practices around you seems rather strange. But he didn't say it once, he didn't say it twice, he has said it consistently. He may well believe it. The other thing that's very remarkable about him is, in those 16 years, there was an enormous scandal, a very famous scandal, with a man called Lai Chai-xing, who ended up, in fact, taking refuge in Canada and only recently returned to China under an amnesty agreement. The enormous smuggling scandal in the mid-1990s, which involved many, many senior leaders, billions of dollars, the famous Red Mansion scandal in which we talk about maybe every single official in the province being involved in some kind of larceny and some kind of venality, huge amounts of money. But the one leader of that time who was not affected by this and remained clean was Xi Jinping. In 2010, there was a meeting in Beijing in which Xi Jinping's mother summoned his family around him and told them all that they needed to ensure that they kept their hands clean. This resistance to temptation is important. As I said, the Communist Party has become an incredible money-making machine. But the problem really is that there is still a kind of moral calculation, a kind of idea, a culture that it's really not on. You can stand in the Politburo, you can see all of these temptations around you, but really can you take them when your enemies are also all around you? It seems quite remarkable, therefore, that from the moment in which Xi Jinping came to positions of power in 2012, that he has been prosecuting an incredible, concerted, unprecedented campaign against corruption. But it seems to me if we interpret this as a political vendetta, if we interpret this as some kind of campaign to score, to sort of kind of strike scores against old leaders, it would be the wrong interpretation. We are, in fact, I think when we look at Xi Jinping, looking into the eyes of a true believer. It doesn't mean that he is an ideologue. It doesn't mean that he is someone who believes profoundly in Marxism-Leninism, but it does mean, I think, that he believes that the party has to survive, the party has to exist for China to achieve the great dream. Well, what is that dream? It's the dream that Xi Jinping has been talking about a lot, the China dream, over the last 18 months. And the dream, it seems to me, is on two levels. The first level is the level that Xi Jinping is in charge of. It's the level that he's been talking about for most of his previous life as a politician up till now. It is that kind of attempt to reach the emotions of the Chinese people when in many ways they feel alienated and fed up with politicians like anywhere else. It is a dangerous thing to try and do to reach those emotions. The only politician since 1949 who really did it was Mao Zedong. It was a costly exercise. It led to absolute devastation, to massive social mobilization campaigns from 1951 that ended up with things like the Cultural Revolution, a kind of dark night of the soul from 1966 onwards. Playing around with the emotions of the Chinese people in the way that politicians try and play with emotions in the West is not an easy thing to do these days. And certainly since 1978, it has been about technocratic, practical leadership, having clear GDP growth outcomes, keeping it simple, keeping the narrative straight. And therefore, when you talk about dreaming, when you talk about aspirations and hope in this context, it is a risky thing to do. But in fact, it is probably the only thing that he can do. The incredible jelly, really, the sort of thing that holds all of this disparate, complicated, fragmented, incredibly large society and entity together, the People's Republic of China, with its 1.4 billion people and its 31 provinces and autonomous regions and all the different ethnic complexity. The one thing that probably holds them together in many ways is the thing that he's talking about, the dream of a life which is better tomorrow than today, a dream of a life in which China, after the narrative of humiliation in the century from 1840 onwards, is now at last ready to stand forward, ready to become a world power, ready to take up its status, its natural role. How terrible it would be, therefore, to be a leader at this time when you really were in touch, where we were nearly close to that great dream, to basically mess it up. And therefore, it seems to me that when Xi Jinping talks about this dream, he is tapping into something that was talked about a century ago, of the idea of a rich, strong nation. In Chinese, that is Fu Qiang Guojia, a rich, Fu Qiang, strong Guojia nation. Rich, strong nation. That is something that transcends political boundaries. It transcends, many ways, ethnic boundaries. It is, if we stick with the party, if we stay with the party, we will achieve this. We will get through. We will become a great nation again, worthy of our historic past. But there is also a practical dimension, and the man in charge of that, Li Keqiang, is a completely different character to Xi Jinping. Li Keqiang is in fact the first lawyer who has been in the Seven Strong Standing Committee, the people that run this country. In the Seven Strong Standing Committee, he is the macroeconomist, and for him it is not about the China dream, it is about the idea of what is the perfect citizen, the most, you know, kind of valuable citizen in the next 10 years. Li Keqiang, as a trained lawyer and an economist, has talked about the great structural imbalances of the Chinese economy, the fact that consumption is low, the fact that Chinese people are not spending in the way that they should to create a modern economy, the fact that the services sector is so low as a proportion of the economy, something like 40% in an economy which is developed, that would be about 65 or 70%. The fact that urbanization needs to speed up, even though it has been incredible over the last 30 years, how quickly China has urbanized. The fact that China needs to radically change and modernize, even after so many years of reform, its economic model. For Li Keqiang, therefore, the China dream, the kind of vision, is very different. It is not about the abstract sense of a great nation achieving its destiny. It is about something much more practical. For him, the perfect Chinese citizen in 2024 will be a higher spending, urban living, service sector orientated taxpayer. Chinese people have many splendid qualities. I have lived there for 7 years. I've visited almost 80 times. But one thing I know in my heart when I look at a Chinese person is that you're not looking at a taxpayer. They have therefore 50% of fiscal revenue for the government is from state-owned enterprises, 10% from personal taxation. That is about the other way round when we look in an economy like Australia. When we have that journey, therefore, to the Li Keqiang dream, to the tax-paying, service-orientated, consuming Chinese citizen, we have an incredible political journey. A profoundly difficult political journey, because that is the journey towards citizenship. That is the journey towards a new kind of loyalty. That is the journey towards me paying for you guys out of my pocket and you irritating the hell out of me because you're not doing what I want. That kind of involvement, therefore, in the political process is at the heart of the project that these new leaders have to deal with. They have to make something completely new, completely different. The future, therefore, is a China dream with a China citizen at the heart of it. That is the crucible of Chinese modernity that they are working on. I want to very finally talk about one other figure from this leadership who is incredibly important, but is certainly someone that I imagine most people outside of China would never have heard of. He is the defender of the faith. He is the keeper of orthodoxy. He is the man who controls the message. This man is called Liu Yunxian, and he in fact lived in an area in which I lived, in Inner Mongolia, for a number of years before he went to Beijing. He is the great exception in this leadership, because Liu Yunxian is actually the only one who did not have a provincial leadership position. He was never a party secretary or a governor of any of the provinces or autonomous regions. He came really through the propaganda apparatus. But Mr. Liu Yunxian is in charge of the message, and he is also in charge of the messenger in China. It is he who has prescribed that foreign journalists have such a tough time. It is he who has prescribed that in classrooms there should be no talk of universalism, of Western values, of things like bicameral, political, parliamentary systems, and all of these messy, irritating things that come from outside. There should be a pure ideological vision for the party, and that is the standard Marxist-Leninist control of the party at the centre, and that's filtered down into the provinces. Liu Yunxian, in fact, is someone who has spoken about the message, not just the China dream, not just the Li Keqiang perfect citizen, but the message. And for him, in 2009, when he talked about what China should learn from the Beijing Olympics and all of the issues over that year, he did make some comments at the party school in which he talked about why was it that the world really didn't understand what China was doing. To about 2,000 cadres in a training session at that time, he talked about how China should reflect upon that tough year, 2008, when there was the great uprising in Tibet. Early in the year, there was the Beijing Olympics, which caused so much fractiousness, really, in the rest of the world. And then there was, finally, the terrible Wenchuan earthquake, which killed about 80,000 people. Liu Yunxian talked about each of these events in a very different way. On the Wenchuan earthquake, he really said, why is it that our incredible ability to manage crises, the party's ability to get the military and all of the different organizations to really contribute to the management of this crisis, why was it not appreciated? When he talks about the Beijing Olympics, he said, why is it that we spent $50 billion on this enormous event, a global party for the world to understand and see the great things that China has been doing over the last 30 years? Why is it that we just didn't get the appreciation and the recognition from the rest of the world that we deserved? He then concluded, well, it's pretty simple. Foreigners never get it. A similar thing was said by Li Keqiang in 2009 when he talked about the economic crisis. As China's deputy macroeconomist now China's chief macroeconomist, he talked about the collapse of Western markets, of the need for China to create within itself indigenous sources of growth. He talked about the incredible necessity to create in the sources of growth within China, to unleash what he called new sources of growth. And he said, quite simply, we cannot rely on European export markets and American export markets and export markets elsewhere, because foreigners always mess up. We must rely on ourselves. That is probably a very powerful, and maybe it's a sensible message. Who knows? Maybe foreigners always do mess up. But it's also pretty true that with this leadership and the incredible challenges that they have faced, that they have also plenty of opportunities to mess up. Whether we like them, whether we like their system of power, whether we like them as people or not, who really knows? But the thing is that, in fact, what they are doing intimately engages and matters to us. I did, in fact, meet Liu Yunxian last month in Denmark, actually in June in Denmark, when we were part of a small seminar talking to him about the party and its mission, the party and its kind of need to get its message across. I also felt like that taxi driver in Beijing that I had been summoned to Copenhagen, one of the most splendid cities in the world, really on a bit of a kind of wild goose chase. I thought it was a bit of a joke. And I therefore was rather surprised, because I didn't expect Mr. Liu would turn up, and I was standing talking to a bunch of European scholars when suddenly a squadron of sniffer dogs appeared. And that made me think, oh my God, this is real. Mr. Liu did in fact appear, and he sat with us. He heard our comments. A German colleague with what would you call it tactfully? I suppose a German academic with the incredible firm fidelity to telling it as it is, said to Mr. Liu, well, we have huge problems in getting access to do field research in China, and your government should make things easier for us. We should have more free access. Mr. Liu looked at him and said, well, I think you're studying the wrong thing in the wrong way. I guess that I really hope today that just with some of the flavour of these leaders, these different kinds of personal narratives and these different backstories, that we can avoid Mr. Liu looking at us and saying with severity, we are studying the wrong things in the wrong way. I think finally, in conclusion, I really want to talk about, you know, the extraordinary importance of us understanding a little more of what their ambitions for their country are. Of course, there are many things that the Communist Party does which are unpalatable and very difficult. It is not like they have a very great respect in many ways for freedom of expression. It would not be easy, for instance, for me to make this kind of speech in Beijing in Chinese. And yet, I think we also have to understand the extraordinary challenges and the extraordinary narrow space in which they operate. It is like they have fought a really tough battle. There are many terrible things that the party has done, but there was also moments when the party itself had what we call a crossroads moment, when it really was between the crossroads of life and death. There was no joy in the revolution that Mao Zedong won. It cost millions of lives. It was certainly something that saved a country which was extraordinarily decimated by Japanese invasion, by incredible environmental problems. Even in the 1940s, a city like Shanghai became a battlefront in which so many people suffered and died. So I think the only thing we can conclude from this is, when we look at Chinese people, they may not love the party, they may not even particularly like the party, but they do want the best for their country, like anywhere. And for them, their dream is something, whatever we think of the party, we have to take seriously. and I hope tonight at least I've done that. Thank you.
Many thanks to Kerry. So we've got copies of the new emperors, Pao and the Princelings in China, and Anne's got some copies over there. So we now come to questions and discussion on the broad topic of the men behind the mask, the new leadership of China, and the world in which they live. Look, I hope I'm not asking the wrong question in the wrong way, to use your reference, but as you mentioned, the current leader, Xi Jinping, his father was purged in 1962, so just after the Great Leap Forward, and that purge continued right through the Cultural Revolution. As you know, during the estimate now for deaths during the forced famine that was the Great Leap is something like 45 million, probably around that figure. So how does these new emperors, including the man you spoke about, regard Mao now? What do they say publicly, and what do you think they might believe privately?
Well, on the 120th anniversary of Mao's birth last December, all of the Standing Committee of the Politburo went to his mausoleum in Beijing, and so they said that he was an important leader and that he was the father of the nation and the founding father. So they have kept to the party line, literally. Of course, I think in their hearts they're very ambiguous. So Xi Jinping himself said that in the Cultural Revolution he suffered badly. And his colleague Yu Jiangsheng, who is on the Politburo, I think is the head of the United Front, his sister committed suicide in the Cultural Revolution, and his mother probably died in the Cultural Revolution. So I think they are ambiguous. But I don't think that they can jettison Mao because he is so central to the unification of China. He is so central to this narrative of a China which has stood up. If they were to get rid of him, they would have to deal with many, many people on the popular level who still really look up to the chairman. And maybe Xi Jinping is a liberal in his heart. Maybe tomorrow he'd love to have a massive reassessment of Mao Zedong. But I think he would like, I guess, in any political culture, if you want to reassess a great historic figure, you kind of think, do we sort of stir things up or do we just let it lie? And at the moment, they let it lie.
Right, so just come back. Yes, the question down there. Don't stand in front of the camera. Just stay here. Yep.
Thank you. Well, just was wondering, how does China's government reconcile the Marxist ideology we have with the seemingly capitalist economy today, cherry picks?
So how does the Chinese government reconcile the Marxist theory with the capitalist reality?
The party school in Beijing undertook a massive study about 10 years ago of the Catholic Church. And they wanted to understand how it was that the Catholic Church had maintained cohesiveness over so many centuries and whether it was something they could emulate. I guess if you asked many believers, either Catholic or Protestant, sort of delicate issues or complicated issues of doctrine, they wouldn't really know, but they would say, we are believers. And I guess for members of the Communist Party, it's a little bit similar. That's why it's not really like a political party. It's almost like a kind of faith. It's a nationalistic sort of faith. But I think that the reconciliation is, well, Marxism, Leninism, that deals with some kinds of issues, and capitalism, in a Chinese way, deals with other issues. And the link is always that it has to have Chinese characteristics.
Let's go down the back, then we come over the side. Yeah?
I had the impression from what you were saying about the desire for a rich, strong China that that really amounts to nationalism, and that in the current environment with South China Sea incidents and things of that sort, the growing power of China in this century, what do you see happening in terms of Chinese expansion in the rest of the Pacific area? The
question is, what at stake here really nationalism, and what are the consequences of that?
Well, I think it's clear that China now feels, as it is the world's second biggest economy, that it should have more global status. But it's also unlikely that it would want the role that America's got. It keeps out of many issues. the Middle East it's tried to keep out of. It's invested a lot in Africa, in Latin America, but mostly driven by its own resource needs. It doesn't want to play a global policeman. So I think you can say that China within the region wants more strategic space, and the maritime issues with Japan, with Vietnam, with the Philippines are part of that story, and it probably wants to be taken more seriously. Whether it is willing to push hard till you get to an actual moment of confrontation, that's an interesting question, because many people think it's already crossed a number of red lines, but I personally think it's very unlikely. It doesn't want an unstable external environment because it has so many big internal issues, and probably the reason why it sounds more nationalistic is because for leadership anywhere, beating up on your neighbours is a great way of keeping people at home happy.
Yes. Down the back, and then we'll come up. Yep.
Professor Brown, I was interested in your comments that Xi Jinping's crackdown on corruption is not motivated by a political purge. I've returned from China last year after 13 years there. Every time I saw a crackdown on corruption take place, it was related to political purge. But more importantly, in 2011 or 2012, Bloomberg was blocked in China because of a story it ran that Xi Jinping's extended family had $20 billion in assets overseas. If not by corruption, how is that possible? And given that his daughter is a student at Harvard, and unlike Tony Abbott's daughter, I'm pretty sure she's not there on a scholarship, how do you attest to the fact that you're claiming he isn't politically corrupt and this isn't a politically motivated purge of the party?
I think we picked that up. It's a question on corruption.
Well, I suppose using that as a model, the answer I would give was yes. I think that the Bloomberg story, in fact, was not as big as 20 billion. I think that was for the Wen Jiabao family. That was the New York Times Wen Jiabao family, and that was billions. Zhou Yongkang, the man who's now been felled, the former Politburo member, that has been significant sums. For Xi Jinping, the Bloomberg story, if I remember rightly, was millions. It wasn't, it was kind of more indirect family. So it was, I think, his sister-in-law or his brother-in-law in Hong Kong property. So it's sensitive, it doesn't look great, but it's not something that directly relates to his very, very close family. I think why I say that it is a different kind of campaign is because it is so much more risky. A good old political vendetta campaign like that against Chen Liangyu, who was in Shanghai and felled in 2005-06, or against Cheng Xitong, who was in Beijing and felled by Jiang Zemin a decade earlier, was only out to get one person, really. They got one big person and then maybe a few smaller. But this campaign has been going on for 18 months. It's got one senior military leader, Hainan province, one of the deputy leaders there. It's got Zhou Yongkang now. Never before in the Communist Party history since 1949 has a Politburo standing committee member been felled for corrupt, or retired member been taken in for investigation for corruption. I mean, that is unique. Under Mao, for political reasons, people were dealt with very brutally, but for corruption, and according to the investigation, the Central Discipline Investigation Committee, to go through that process, this is unique. So that seems to me risky. It seems to me quite interesting that no one around Xi Jinping in the leadership, the Seven Strong Standing Committee, have opposed it so far, have made any sign that they oppose it. And there would be little signs, little bits and pieces if they did oppose it. And it seems quite interesting that there isn't much opposition, even in the Central Committee. So it seems to me that this is a consensus-led attack. It would be misinterpreting it to say that this is Xi the strong man, Xi Jinping the sort of godfather, as I think one guy called him. I think it's really because the party knows this issue is so urgent, they have to cut some really, really big figures. And Zhou Yongkang was a great guy to cut.
Question down there. We've got plenty of time. So, yeah,
okay. If I could just ask, it's sort of linked to the question about vendettas and political motivations. Could you talk a little bit about the factions that might exist at that upper echelons of power?
What's a question about factions in China?
I don't believe in factions. I think there are different networks, and everyone has a kind of provincial network. They kind of build constituencies around them. So in my book, The New Emperors, out now, available here, it does describe the different kinds of networks that are around leaders and how they recruited those in order to get where they are. Because everything in this highly deliberative political environment in China has a reason. There isn't open campaigning, but you do build supportive networks around you in order to get to the top. Some of those are military, some of those are business, some of those are family, and in fact, to really kind of do the hard sell, there's also the slight matter of the mistresses.
There's a question there, yes.
Thank you very much for your talk, Professor Brown. By the way, my name is Leonard Brown. A few years ago, Henry Kissinger made a statement to the effect that when China becomes a strong world power, it will adopt ancient Chinese philosophy rather than Marxism, liberalism, socialism, or communism to guide its international relations. Please tell us whether you agree with
it. So the suggestion was that Henry Kissinger said that when China becomes a great power, it will abandon these modern beliefs and go back to more traditional Chinese beliefs.
Maybe Dr. Kissinger, when he talked about ancient wisdom, was talking about one of his early books, because they did come out rather early. But I think when we look at someone like Hu Jintao, for instance, he talked about taking people as the base, you know, taking people as the core. So that's the sort of reference, I think, to Mencius or Confucian, Mencian, kind of ancient philosophy. And Xi Jinping has alluded to the need to tap into traditional Chinese philosophy and its culture, its cultural memory. So I suppose this leadership, they want more diverse kind of intellectual resources, and they realize that their history has many of those at hand. So I think it's probably likely that we'll see much more of that in the future. They've started doing a bit-by-bit harmonious society, for instance. That's also a reference to Confucianism, and I'm sure that they'll use it more in the future. Whether that won't sound rather conservative and old-fashioned, I mean, that's a kind of maybe one of the dangers of doing that sort of thing.
Question right down the back there. Yeah. Yes.
Hello. Do you know what they think the point is of becoming a world power?
The question is, what's the point of China becoming a world power, presumably from the point of view of China's leaders?
The point of becoming a world power for them is because of the strong memory of humiliation and victimization when they were not a strong power. So the best insurance is to make sure that they are respected and feared, probably that they are more dominant, because they don't want to revisit a disunited, ununified China, which existed for much of the early 20th century and which was victimized and beaten up, invaded and humiliated by outsiders. So a simple answer would be that that's what they don't want, and to prevent that, that's why they want a strong, powerful country.
Official statistics tend to indicate that the number of social incidents have grown rapidly over the last 20 years, incidents involving police. How really stable is the China? Will that legitimacy of Communist Party be maintained if economics stand down?
Well, since 2001, social mass incidents have risen dramatically, that's true. And everyone knows, until about 2005, the government collected statistics, and there were 88,000 every year, and then they stopped collecting them because they said they weren't that meaningful. though I think Yu Jiangrong of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences has continued to collect statistics, and he said last year there were, I think, 200,000 mass incidents.
So 200,000. Yeah, but it started some time ago.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, these are, of course, a huge problem. And while China is rich, it can deal with them. It can deal with them by spending $111 billion every year on internal security, which is $5 billion more than it spends on its national defense. That was a 2011 statistic. So it can deal with that level of contention at the moment. But a single one of those incidents could spark a prairie fire. It could spark an uprising. And so you could say that China now has been in an era of deep contentiousness for about a decade, and that isn't coming to an end at the moment.
Okay, so it's down the back there. Yeah, Quang.
Professor Brown, thank you very much. In your view, how important is the issue in the Sea or South China Sea? Is it important to achieve the things that we felt that we have seen personally?
Okay, so in your view, how important is the incidents in the South China Sea to the current Chinese leadership?
Well, it certainly intensified, although it started before they came into their positions in 2012, it's intensified. And maybe that's also to do with the fact that some of the countries around, I mean, Vietnam, Japan in the East China Sea, have stronger or at least more assertive leadership now. They are pushing back. And maybe in China they also feel that Obama has been quite a weak president. So I think it's important that they find a face-saving exit, I suppose. Not an exit, but a face-saving resolution. The key to that might be some sort of resource-sharing deal that puts final sovereignty on the kind of shelf for many, many years. It's unlikely that we're going to sort out the sovereignty issues for a long, long time, because China's position is based on historical claim and many of the others are basing it on a kind of developing international law. So you have two totally different mindsets at the moment.
Thank you, Professor. Just following on from that discussion and an earlier question, China's had fractious relationships for centuries with some of those countries, particularly the Japanese and Vietnamese, of course, which leads me to ask, firstly, North Korea, and then secondly, Russia. Is there any sign or any comment about what the attitude will be of the new leadership with respect to the North Korean issue? Because China seems it's only sort of supporter, and particularly given what's been happening between Russia and Ukraine and Europe.
Okay.
With that, maybe have some.
So, a question about North Korea and Russia.
So, since Kim Jong-un became leader in North Korea in late 2011, I think it was, he hasn't had a single visit to Beijing, and there hasn't been. Xi Jinping certainly hasn't been to North Korea. So, they may say they're close, but they haven't had any contact at that level. I think Xi Jinping looks down with disdain on the North Koreans. He thinks that they're a huge liability, but they don't want the Americans to get involved. They don't want a unified peninsula because of the Americans creeping up to their northeastern border. So I think in the early part of this year they stopped sending energy to North Korea, and that is also a sign that they have very frosty relations at the moment. But the more worrying thing is I don't think that China has a roadmap to deal with the North Korean issue. On Russia, they've just signed an enormous energy deal. Xi Jinping apparently is a big admirer of Mr. Putin. But I think it's a relationship without trust. It doesn't need to have trust. It has 25 years of liquid natural gas to fuel it.
Okay, so there's a question there. Yeah.
Since we're observing the anniversary of World War I, is there any resemblance between the relationship between China and the USA and Britain and unified Germany?
My personal opinion is no, because the First World War Christopher Clark's excellent book, The Sleepwalkers, I think it's called, shows that that was bureaucratic incompetence and complacent leadership and kind of alliances that basically set things on a disastrous path. And it seems as everyone in the Asian region now is talking about this being like the First World War, it's going to make it very unlikely that that sort of thing is going to happen. Though the idea that there could be a limited clash, for instance, between China and Japan, that is possible. That is absolutely possible. And the symbolic, kind of importance of that would be huge. So we shouldn't be complacent about that.
Right down the back, yeah.
The anxiety that seems to exist around Chinese investment in Australia, whether it's in our resources or in our residential property, there seems to be some Australian xenophobia against China and influence people. What do you think we can love about China, and what can we welcome about China that, what's your
sales
job on China
for
Australia?
Well, there's a suggestion about Chinese xenophobia about China in Australia. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Chinese investment has increased very dramatically over the last 5 years, very quickly. So I suppose that's unsettling. That's always unsettling when something new happens. A lot of it has been state money, and a lot of it has been in resources. But I think the issue really is that we can certainly in Australia, we can think of Chinese investment here being a way of us having strategic partnerships back into the market of China, because the potential growth there for this 750 million strong emerging middle class that Li Keqiang at the moment is creating is going to be a far vaster economic opportunity than, with the best will in the world, anything here, just because of its scale, the size, and the fact that Chinese people are not spending at the moment. So although everyone quotes Napoleon and says when China stands up, it will shake the world, I think actually we can probably say that when Chinese citizens start spending money, they're going to shake the world and probably buy most of it.
Yes?
Given the comments about asking the wrong questions in the wrong way, so how well are the power elites in the US, Europe and Australia actually addressing the Chinese ethos?
Wow. I think that there are people who are deeply engaged. There are some politicians who really do know that this is a significant thing, that China is now a global player economically in the environment and climate change and issues like this. And so I think that they are thinking through the scenarios of what's, how is China going to become a bigger stakeholder? I suppose the issue really is that there are going to be certain issues where Western elites are going to have to compromise pretty profoundly. So international governance, the United Nations maybe, how crazy that only 5 permanent members now, and only one of them is Asian. It seems very strange. So I think that there will probably be moments of compromise where politicians will have to be out in front of public opinion in their countries, and they will have to be very skillful at explaining that in the long term this is for the good, but in the short term people might feel a little bit uneasy.
Dmitry.
Thank you, Professor Duran. Do you have any observations on the economic stability of China?
Question about the economic stability of China.
Well, I think it's pretty clear the year of double-digit growth is over. Growth in the last quarter was 7.5%. I think the projection is in the next 5-year program, which runs from 2016, you'll see growth creeping down to, sort of about 6.5%. The idea really that growth will disappear, though, no one has had that, but it is possible. There could be a collapse of, the banking system in China. There could be an enormous problem with the debts that Chinese local government have built up. There could be a collapse of the environment. That's perfectly possible. So the issue really is that the party knows absolutely that at the moment it has 7.5% loyalty, and sometime in the future it will only have 3% loyalty, and it needs to change the way it governs, as it has less money to pay people off and it has to deliver totally different kinds of things.
Yeah. We're getting near the end, so we'll be brief.
Could you say a bit more about how we should view Xi Jinping? On the one hand, there's the anti-corruption drive, which could suggest something of a reformer or a potential reformer. On the other hand, there are clear moves to strengthen the position of the party, to strengthen and clarify his position as the leader of the party.
Okay, so
the power structure. How do we balance?
How do you regard him as a reformer or not?
I think he's going to be a reformer whether he likes it or not, because the party's position at the moment is unsustainable. It cannot continue just to focus on GDP growth. It's got to deal with governance and other issues and sustainability issues. whether he makes the right or wrong tactical decision, whether he decides to prioritize dealing with the environment or governance and making China more stable, those are things that matter profoundly to us. So I suppose our only real response pragmatically is that we have to try and work with the Chinese leadership that will introduce reforms that promote stability but also a more harmonious, a less contentious China and a cleaner China in terms of its environment.
Question there? Yes.
Thank you, Professor Brown. With the Chinese mentality, the Chinese leadership are committed to assist in any meaningful way with large-scale humanitarian efforts around the globe.
The question is, can China participate in large-scale humanitarian efforts around the world?
Over the last 15 years, they have taken part in peacekeeping missions that have been under the United Nations. So in Africa, they've certainly done that. They've certainly done it in other parts of Asia. I think that they would be willing to commit more in terms of their aid budget to humanitarian relief. There are some issues that they won't want to get involved with. They have fractious relations with India. They have fractious relations, obviously, with some of their other border countries. And so they would probably be much less prepared to be involved with those. But on the whole, their humanitarian record is not a bad one. It's not a bad one.
Second last question in here.
Yeah. Is this based on economic imperative, or is it value-based? Health, well-being, their whole reform there, and following on from the last question.
I think it's based on a transition from economic value system to something more complicated. And I don't think they have, because it's so complicated, the right answer at the moment, but they know that just telling people it's all about GDP growth won't work.
In the past, I think it's fair to say that some academics have been reluctant to criticize China because it will affect their visas or their research opportunities within China, but you've put out a book and you seem to be talking to the Chinese leadership in Copenhagen. So how are you regarded in Beijing by the leadership?
I have met Xi Jinping once. I imagine that I remember him. I don't think he remembers me.
But access? You're a critic, you get access?
I think it's okay if you have looked at what they're trying to do and the challenges. I think that's okay. I mean, I'm not sort of taking an ideological position. I'd like to understand what it feels like to stand in the position they're standing and to try and work out the things that they're dealing with. And the more I've been sort of thinking about this, the more incredibly difficult it is what they're trying to do. For them, running Australia would be a wonderful job to do on a Sunday afternoon, because they would think of the China dream as being our lives here. I think they are dealing with awesome problems, and whether you like or don't like their politics and some of the things that they do are really unpalatable, but I think we need to accord them the respect to try and understand and at least get under their skin a bit.
Thanks. As I said, Anne's got copies of The New Emperors over there. I'm sure our speaker would be happy to sign some copies. And thanks to Kerry Brown for an important description of and comment on the Chinese leadership of a nation which is important to us in Australia, as we are important to the Chinese leadership in China. So it's been a very informative speech today. I'm sure we'll have you back again in the future, but for tonight, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.